I've never actually used them.
States Court of Appeals for Veterans Claims is now in session. The Honorable Robert M. Davis presiding. All that worth business before this court draw near and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this Honorable Court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I'm Chief Judge Davis. To my right are Judges Sholin, Bartley, Allen, and Toth. To my left are Judges Peach, Greenberg, Meredith, and Falvey. We are here today in the matter of Walter G. Long against Robert L. Wilkie, docket number 16-1537, to consider whether the board erred when it determined that Mr. Long's service-connected hearing loss did not warrant extra scheduler referral. Would counsel for both parties please note your appearance for the record?
Good morning, Your Honor. Jenna Zellmer of the law firm Chisholm, Chisholm, and Kilpatrick. Looking at counsel's table, Zachary Schultz, also of the firm.
Welcome.
Robin Marsh for the secretary.
Welcome. Are both parties ready to proceed?
Yes, sir.
Each party will have 30 minutes to present your respective arguments. Counsel for the appellant, do you wish to reserve any portion of your time for rebuttal?
10 minutes, please.
10 minutes. Thank you. Ms. Zellmer, you may proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Davis, Your Honors, and may it please the court. The court's current framework for evaluating extrascheduler consideration, which has been established through more than 10 years of sound case law, remains viable. The Secretary's proposed framework simply restates the court's current analysis in different and more vague terms. Essentially, he agrees that the framework is viable. He just does not believe that it should ever actually be applied. The application of the current framework makes sense because it ensures that VA maximizes benefits, it ensures that the full scope of a veteran's disability is compensated, and it is, as the Secretary has said, a fail-safe. It is the last resort after the veteran has exhausted all scheduler remedies. Now, Morgan has made clear, and of course the cases that preceded it have clearly laid out, a workable framework by which the board can evaluate a veteran's disabilities. And that begins with the schedule and the scheduler tools that VA has laid out. And that's clear in Morgan. And as Morgan has made clear, the board can ensure by using these scheduler tools first that extra scheduler consideration is truly reserved for the exceptional case. I think the facts of this case demonstrate how that works. Mr. Long applied for a scheduler higher rating. He didn't meet the scheduler rating, but he also had symptoms of his disability that were outside of the objective rating criteria for the hearing loss criteria. And so the board did consider secondary service connection for anxiety and depression. The RO did. And the RO denied secondary service connection. And so that scheduler avenue, that scheduler tool in VA's toolbox is exhausted. But even though VA denied secondary service connection, the fact still remains that the veteran has self-esteem issues due to his hearing loss disability, and he has ear pain. He also has social isolation. I think it's really important to remember when we're talking about this highly conceptualized notion of extra scheduler to bring it back to earth and bring it back to how this affects a personal veteran. And so Mr. Long served his country. He served as an air traffic control, a radar repairman. And in that role in service in the Air Force, he was exposed to noise exposure. And so he came back from service and he applied for disability benefits. And he said in his own words that his hearing loss and his tinnitus affected all avenues of his life. It affected his ability to maintain relationships. It caused ear pain when he used his hearing aids. And eventually, when he went to vocational rehab and started doing student teaching, he had self-esteem issues. He was worried that his students would feel that he was dumb because he couldn't hear them and couldn't understand them. And so these are symptoms and effects that are not contemplated by the objective rating criteria of the rating disability, of the rating criteria. Excuse me. And so when the veteran received his rating decision, he got a 0% rating, and he doesn't understand why a 0% rating is adequate to compensate him for all of those effects that are not listed in the rating criteria.
Well, so you started out by admitting that extra scheduler evals are for exceptional cases, and then you named some symptoms or attributes or effects that he has that you think are not covered by the hearing loss rating schedule.
Yes, Your Honor.
But the things that you've named to me, this is just my personal take on this, don't seem exceptional at all. Like, yeah, you get, I think he mentioned depression and anxiety that didn't receive a diagnosis of a mental disorder. But, I mean, whenever I have disabilities, chronic even, they are depressing. They do make me anxious. That people will think that I am equivalent to the disability. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They do create self-esteem problem. Like that seems. These seem like universal, somewhat universal. I wouldn't want to make crazy generalizations here, but somewhat universal for people who have disabilities. So how does that make him different or unique or exceptional?
Well, I think the first step is to look at the rating criteria, and in this case, the rating criteria are objective, and so the rating criteria doesn't account for any of those symptoms, and that's the first step, and that's not necessarily going to mean that renders his disability exceptional or unusual, but it raises the suggestion that it might be, because the secretary is the one who is making this rating schedule. If they're truly typical symptoms, you would assume that they were in that rating schedule, or you would assume that some other scheduler avenue would be able to compensate the veteran for those particular symptoms. And so
VA went down that road with the mental related ones.
Yes.
And he didn't get a separate disability, diagnosis, as I said, and so they just denied secondary service connection for mental condition, and he didn't appeal.
Yeah, I think, Your Honor, you're correct, he didn't appeal, but I think that the timeline of the rating decision that denied anxiety and depression is really important here. So that happened in 2011. In September 2011, there was a rating decision that denied service connection for anxiety and depression. One, the examiner didn't talk about his self-esteem issues at all, and I would argue that self-esteem issues are different than anxiety and depression, particularly in this case where the examiner denied a separate rating or a separate secondary service connection for the specific diagnosis of anxiety and depression. He still has these symptoms of self-esteem issues. And second, I think that the self-esteem issues really manifested after this rating decision. And so the rating decision took place in September 2011. It wasn't until January of 2012 where he began student teaching. And that's when he says that he really began getting anxious about beginning student teaching because he was worried that the students would think he would look or sound stupid. His mental health treatment notes after 2011 in April 2012 said that he had recently completed student teaching. And then in August 2012, his hearing testimony, he said that student teaching really brought out these self-esteem issues. And so I think the problem with the board's decision here is that the board just kind of said, well, the RO denied secondary service connection, so we're not going to talk about this at all. And the problem with that is that it didn't consider the context of the veteran's self-esteem issues and anxiety and depression, and that's on page, I believe, 7 of the record. 7 of the record, page 6 of the board decision. The board just says, it lists the veteran's symptoms of anxiety and depression, and then it just says the RO ultimately denied secondary service connection. But that doesn't mean that his symptoms went away. And in fact, that after that secondary service connection decision is when his self-esteem issues really came into focus. And so I think when you're looking at the rating criteria and the extra scheduler analysis, you're starting with the schedule. And I think that the court made this clear in Morgan. You start with a schedule, you exhaust all the scheduler tools in VA's toolbox, and then if you're left with something after that that doesn't fit into the schedule, that raises the possibility that extra scheduler consideration might be warranted. It doesn't mean that every veteran is gonna get an extra scheduler rating, and I think that goes back to your point, Judge Bartley, about how we have to determine whether it really is an exceptional or unusual disability, but it entitles a veteran to the consideration in the first instance.
But I mean, how so, right? I mean, what would be the limiting principle if the subjective experience of the veteran were the relevant criterion? I don't know how that could contain any limiting principle. And just in terms of the particular context, as Judge Bartley described, in which people, when they incur disabilities, how that affects their lives is really unique to them. I don't see how if we were to start to take these principles into account, I don't see how we could, any cutoff point or how we could even reasonably evaluate them in any objective way.
Well, I think that's why the symptoms and severity of a veteran's particular disability are so important, Judge Toth. So, for example, if we were looking at a different situation where this veteran didn't have symptoms of anxiety and depression, he didn't have self-esteem issues, he didn't have ear pain, he would fit very clearly within the scheduler rating criteria. And it's when these other symptoms come into being that we kind of have to go into the other scheduler avenues, so secondary service connection, separate ratings, analogous ratings, and then after that analysis is when we think about whether or not extra scheduler consideration is warranted. And I think your point is right that it demonstrates that extra scheduler is going to be reserved for an exceptional disability picture. A veteran, I think you're right that a lot of veterans are going to feel that their specific rating isn't adequately compensated, but if they can't show that there's something there, that either the severity is so much worse than his assigned rating, or if there's a specific symptom that's not contemplated by the rating, then we're not going to get into the extra scheduler analysis.
If I can interrupt, you talked about that they can show that their severity is worse or that they have symptoms that aren't contemplated. Well, in the diagnostic code, we're talking about hearing loss. There is no severity. There's a Roman numeral. There is no symptom. So how does the board know, or how does a veteran know, or how does the court know whether a veteran should have higher rating based on the severity of his hearing loss? Or how does a veteran know, or the court know, whether ear pain is contemplated?
I think Doucette answered that question, Your Honor. Doucette distinguished between audiological symptoms and effects and non-audiological symptoms and effects. And so, if a veteran has very typical hearing loss symptoms, such as not being able to converse with people, not being able to hear people unless they're, looking at the person's lips, those are things that, even though they're not expressly listed in the objective rating criteria, I think those are things that VA meant to compensate as a hearing loss disability. But I think when you get outside of that audiological framework and you get into these non-audiological issues like psychiatric manifestations and pain, and I believe in Doucette they talked about social isolation, and I know there was some discussion in Doucette and King in the cases that followed about whether or not social isolation really is a disability or a desirable or a non-desirable functional effect. I think at the end of the day, that's something that the board at least has to consider because it's non-audiological.
Do you think that the determination of whether something is part of the rating criteria or not is a medical question, or is it a legal question? Is that something the board is capable of doing?
I think it's a legal question, Your Honor. I think it's an interpretation of the rating criteria, and so that would be a legal question.
Can I go back to what you said about anxiety and depression, that it was denied on a secondary basis? I don't believe we have a full copy of the September 2011 rating decision in the ROP. What record is it that you're looking at where the RO denied secondary service connection?
No.
Can I add? Please.
I think it's at 453. Is it?
The decision stops mid-sentence there.
No, you're not. I'm not.
You're correct, Your Honor. I see what you mean about the paragraph. There's a paragraph that says secondary or service connection for depressive disorder not otherwise specified.
But you're conceding that that decision denied on a secondary basis as well. So what?
Yes, Your Honor.
What is it you're asking us to do with regard to anxiety and depression? Put aside self-esteem for a moment. Are you asking us to consider that on an extra scheduler basis?
Yes, Your Honor. So I believe in our pleadings, we focus mainly on self-esteem issues because, as I mentioned, that specific effect wasn't addressed in the secondary service connection decision. You know, I do think it's kind of interesting, though, that the September 2011 rating decision denied secondary service connection, and then within a year of that rating decision is when he testified at his hearing that his student teaching revealed self-esteem issues. And, you know, obviously we didn't plead this, but I do think that kind of raises the issue about whether or not that rating decision from 2011 was ever final, if he did submit new material evidence in the form of this hearing testimony within the year, and that hasn't been adjudicated below. But I do think it just goes to the fact that he does have these psychiatric manifestations that have not adequately been compensated.
Okay, so let's turn to the other symptoms you talked about, self-esteem, ear pain, and social isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Are you contending that any of those attributes, whatever we call them, lead to marked interference with employment?
I'm contending that in this particular case, the veteran has stated that he had interference with employment, and the board didn't properly consider whether or not that met the second.
Where's the evidence of marked interference with employment? Did he have employment during the period on appeal other than student teaching?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, but on page 428, he had a letter from his mental health counselor, and he said that the veteran has been struggling working with his student teaching internship due to his hearing issues, and he's also been working on self-esteem issues that have been impacted by his loss of hearing. And so, you know, that might not raise to marked interference. It might. We don't know, because the board didn't actually properly conduct that analysis. Instead of just determining whether or not that met marked interference with employment, the board just said on page 9 of the record.
Regardless of what the board said, don't you have to show to us that there's marked interference with employment? How do we get to prejudice if there's not?
Well, I think the prejudice here is that the veteran deserves to see the board's work, Your Honor. We don't need to prove, and the veteran doesn't need to prove, that he would be entitled to an extra scheduler rating. I think the record establishes that the issue has been raised. You know, the extra scheduler consideration is the only issue on appeal in this board decision, and the board's job was to properly conduct that analysis, and it didn't do so here.
You don't have to make a showing that the outcome might have been different?
I think the outcome might have been different because there is enough evidence that the board might have found that there's marked interference with employment.
If based on the word struggle.
Yes.
Could I ask you, sort of going back, one of the things that's difficult in the context of the ear, the hearing issue for me, is that I'm afraid that the rules as sort of exist now in this context may make it all sort of an advocate's game. In other words, I would think that it would that a skilled advocate, this is somewhat channeling something from Judge Bartley's question, would be able to frame simply by an argument that I can't hear and that makes me frustrated and anxious. And if you frame it that way, it goes into what you're saying, where somebody who might not have as skilled an advocate doesn't actually tie that up. And so it's sort of like in the old days, there used to be a rule that courts couldn't issue affirmative injunctions, meaning they couldn't say, go do this. So what courts started to do is say, stop not going to do this. And they say, so I'm not ordering you to actually do anything, right? And so it's just a question of wording. So how do you deal with the fact here that it seems like the rule that exists in this area is one that just depends on how skillful the counsel is to frame the issue?
So I would disagree, Your Honor. I think that the court, especially in Morgan, has made it very clear what the board is supposed to do and how the board is supposed to consider these symptoms. And it's really based on what the veteran's specific disability picture is and what the records shows. And so, you know, we can't create out of whole cloth an exceptional disability picture just by being an advocate. And I think especially, you know, the Secretary has talked about how extra scheduler has kind of swallowed the rule and created all this needless litigation, but I don't think that's true. I think that the litigation that has gone on up to this point has all been very necessary in order to provide the board with guidance. And so President has really done its job here, and at the end of the day, I think we're kind of trying to solve a problem that no longer exists. It's important to think about the fact that this board decision was from March of 2016. This board decision didn't have the benefit of Doucette or King or, of course, Morgan. And I think that if the board was making this decision and within the court's current framework today, it would be a lot better. And I think anecdotally speaking, I've seen board decisions that have been a lot better. And so, you know, I don't think that this is going to create a situation where advocates just play a game. And the other thing to note is that, you know, at the end of the day, the court might affirm, you know, appeals about extra scheduler consideration, but that doesn't mean that the veteran doesn't deserve his day in court. You know, I think that it's really important to remember that veterans, for a long time, didn't have any judicial recourse, and VA was living in this land of splendid isolation. And so the court has affirmed extra scheduler decisions in its current framework. It affirmed the extra scheduler decision in Doucette. It affirmed it in Chudy, which wasn't an oral argument but was a panel decision. And so, you know, I think that when you're thinking about creating this situation that's really reserved for the exceptional case, the court's framework has solidified that, and it's been consistent with that.
So, Ms. Elmer, what would you like the court to do here?
Thank you, Your Honor. We'd ask this court to affirm its over 10 years of carefully considered case law interpreting 3.321b1. And if the court does decide to overturn its case law, we would believe that the court should still vacate and remand this board's decision for the board to provide adequate reasons and bases. Under either framework, we believe the board failed to provide adequate reasons and bases in denying the veteran's claim for extra scheduler consideration. Thank you.
I know your time's over, but I want to just follow up with one question from Judge Meredith. The 2011 rating decision, that denied secondary service connection because there was no disability, is that right? Or was it decided on another ground, like no nexus?
I think that the examiner did find that the disability had resolved, and that there was some suggestion in the examiner's rationale that the veteran had complained of depression and anxiety in the past due to family issues and not specifically due to hearing loss.
So does that make a difference? Here's what I mean. So something might be, say the rating decision said, taking depression, that we deny secondary service connection because there isn't a diagnosis of depression. Mm-hmm. Well, I could see in that context that okay, maybe you don't have depression to the level that you get a diagnosis, but you still have some symptom, and maybe mm-hmm. that's something left over. But if the would that be different in your view if the rating decision denied based on nexus? Because in that case, then there wouldn't be anything to go to extra scheduler, because it would be weird to say it's not connected to hearing loss, but then say it's for extra scheduler, it's connected to hearing loss. You see what I mean?
I do, Your Honor. And I think that the difference here is that even if the examiner denied for anxiety and depression based on nexus, after that rating decision, there was evidence of a nexus between the veteran's self-esteem issues and his hearing loss.
So yes, but since we're since we're on Bach and it's hard to fit us all up here, right, we like to do it as infrequently as possible. And so, yes, for the self-esteem issues, that's separate because arguably it's never been adjudicated. But if a rating decision says no secondary service connection for this symptom because no nexus, do you agree that that would foreclose then an extra scheduler analysis with respect to that same thing?
Yes, Your Honor, because I think that, you know, in King, the court made clear that there does need to be a sufficient link between the symptoms and effects and the service-connected disability. So if there is no link there, then you can't give extra scheduler consideration for that specific symptom.
And so as to depression and anxiety, in this case, Mr. Long's case, those are off the table given the September 2011 rating decision, assuming it's final, leaving aside 3.156B.
Assuming it's final.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Yes. Okay. Morris, you may have five additional minutes should you need them.
Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the court. Your Honors, it remains the Secretary's position that the current framework for extrascheduler evaluation is no longer viable and must be revised. Your Honors, the court took an important step in Morgan, recognizing that 3.321B is not an alternative path to compensation, but a last resort that's implicated only in those truly rare situations where the VA rating schedule can't be used to adequately compensate a veteran for the average impairment in earning capacity caused by his disability. And there are several points that I'd like to make here, but I'd like to start with that basic acknowledgement because, Your Honors, I believe it goes to the heart of the Secretary's more fundamental point, which is that you cannot develop a viable framework for extrascheduler evaluation without first understanding and appreciating the way disability compensation works, the way that evaluations work, and the way that the rating schedule works. Your Honor, the proper framework for an extrascheduler evaluation is not and cannot be a standalone structure. And I'd like to give a quick analogy here, which is consider it to be something akin to an empty room in a house. You can't expand that room or change its shape without fundamentally interfering with the rest of the house. That room is governed by the same house rules that govern the rest of the house. And in this particular case, we have a landlord who says you can't use that room unless there's no other room in your house that can possibly accommodate your needs. And Your Honor, extra scheduler is like that room in that it is the analysis in that it is defined foremost by the structure that surrounds it and by those house rules. And what we have here is a framework that encroaches on the rest of that house, and it's no longer consistent with those rules. It's no longer consistent with the limited purpose of the regulation 3.321B or the way in which disabilities are evaluated and the rating criteria and codes ascertain disability level. It ignores the house rules, including those of evidentiary requirements and burdens of proof. And Your Honor, it infringes on the rating schedule itself and on the Secretary's authority and prerogative to choose how best to assess disability level. Your Honor, I think there are four points, broad points, that warrant discussion, and I think that they address both the appellant's arguments but also the questions. And those points are, what do we compensate for? How do the diagnostic codes and their criteria work? How do they assess disability level? When, you know, is it that a disability cannot be adequately rated under the rating schedule? And when is the issue of extra scheduler raised? And what are the board's obligations when it is raised? Your Honor, in responding, you know, to the arguments that were raised by the appellant, the first part, what do we compensate for? We compensate for the average impairment in earning capacity caused by a disability. We do not compensate for the actual impairment. We do not compensate by the way in which a disability personally impacts an individual veteran. Again, it's the average impairment in earning capacity. Every veteran is uniquely impacted by a disability. That is expected. And again, it's simply just not the standard. And to that end, Your Honor, it is also important to understand within this concept, you know, the distinctions between the disability and other types of related factors, because I think that often gets lost. The disability is what arises from the underlying injury or disease, or as the case may be, a residual condition. And the disability is the functional impairment. It's the impairment to the normal functioning of the body part, the organ, or the system of the body that's affected by that injury or disease. Those effects, we'll call them, that don't trace back to that injury or disease are not a part of that disability. They may be a separate disability, as in the case of something like depression or anxiety. It's not to say that it doesn't exist, but it is not. But depression and anxiety is not caused by any impairment of the ear.
So are those effects you're talking about, is that what we mean when we say the word functional effects?
It's not entirely clear that that term has been used consistently, because it at times seems to have referred to signs and symptoms, sometimes signs and symptoms related to the underlying injury or disease, sometimes signs and symptoms related to a different potential disability, sometimes merely personal circumstances. So I don't know that that term has any clear and consistent...
Because that term...
Do you think it should be?
I don't believe it's a necessary term. I believe that what we're looking for, with respect to extrascheduler in particular, are the signs and symptoms of the underlying injury or disease. Because if those are unique, if those are exceptional, that the disease gives rise to unusual or exceptional symptoms, then that disability that's created there, that may be one that is not contemplated by the diagnostic coding criteria.
Does that term functional effects show up anywhere in VA regulations or Title 38 or guidance, or is it a creation of our court? I mean, where does it come from? It's surfaced in our cases.
It does. I believe that it is something that has surfaced in cases. I believe that we use the term functional impairment or impairment of function in our regulation. But I believe that that is a term that is that again has been used to refer to any one of a number of different ideas. And I think that's part of the confusion, because again, it distracts from ascertaining whether what we're talking about is a sign or a symptom, whether it's a sign or a symptom of the particular condition that we have, or whether simply this is a collateral effect or the way in which a veteran responds to his or her.
So you would put depression, anxiety, social isolation in the category of collateral effect?
I didn't mean to make up a new term. I think most relevant is that neither anxiety or depression, and here we actually have a medical opinion, it's not just simply not related to the veteran's hearing loss as a potential secondary condition, but it's also not caused by the functioning of the ear. It is related to the psyche, I believe, is, you know, the system, the body part, the system, the organ, or the psyche. And that's what we're looking for. And the Secretary's position here, to be clear, is not suggesting that veterans should be limited in their compensation. The Secretary is making no argument to the extent that veterans should not be adequately compensated. His argument is simply that this avenue is not the appropriate avenue. And waiting for for extra scheduler is not the appropriate time to be raising these issues. And I think that this case illustrates that point. Because
if I can interject, the Secretary wrote the regulation for extra scheduler.
Correct.
So what, can you give me an example of a situation where you think extra scheduler would be appropriate?
I will start by saying that we have discussed that many times, and I can't see a clear example. But what I can do, and there's a reason for it, and I'll start with the reason, and then I will give you an example. The reason is that that was created a long time ago based on the 1945 code, which at the time was a fraction of what exists right now in the VA rating schedule, with a fraction of the provisions, a fraction of the notes, and a fraction of the recognized disabilities, injuries, diseases. It follows that as this the VA rating schedule has expanded and contemplated more and more injuries and diseases and their residual effects, that the use of 3.321B would be more and more limited over time. And I'll give you examples, and examples would include within the hearing context. Prior to, I think it was the 1980s, Meniere's disease didn't exist. Yet one could have a condition that causes the injury, the underlying disease causes hearing loss, instability, balance issues, and so on and so forth. So in that occasion, that may have been one. If all of those were attributed to the same disease, and when looked around the schedule and there was simply no corresponding or analogous code to use, that may have been a that may have been something that would have resulted in the use of 3.321. I'd suggest also that many codes today contemplate extreme and rare situations, that the code for diabetes does, to the extent that it refers out certain other potentially more unusual effects, such as blindness, and it specifically notes rated under blindness, because without that, we might have a situation where 3.321B would have come into play, because this would have been a part of the same disease, that the symptom, so the blindness would have been a result of the disease, not the disability, not the resulting disability, which would be a, a hardship or something.
What you're saying sounds compelling to me, but I'm troubled by the fact that the secretary reissued the regulation with an extremely minor change just a year or two ago. So if they thought that it didn't have any role anymore, why would the agency not withdraw the regulation instead of reaffirming it?
Several reasons. Amongst them, there are political considerations, but also at the time when the secretary was revising this, this was something that is still operating under the under the current framework. However, I suggest for the same reason that the secretary created it in the first place, which is as a safety net. The secretary cannot be certain that he has plugged in every hole in the rating schedule, and that is what it exists for. The secretary has taken the time, and again, based on science, based on medicine, has created a code that contemplates the effects of injuries and disease. It's a disability that's caused by them. It's not to say that the secretary is not infallible and might have left something out, or it's not to say that something couldn't arise in the future that created by something in our modern environment. It's a possibility. I don't know that much. But the reason that it's there is as a safety net. It doesn't mean that it's intended to be used. In fact, it shouldn't be looked at that way. It shouldn't be looked at as an end goal that you get to unless something stops you. It is quite the opposite. It is that last resort. If there is simply nothing else that can accommodate the purpose, which in this case is to adequately rate a disability, then it exists. But again, I would suggest that I cannot think of examples. I'm also not a doctor, so my knowledge is limited as to what type of disease or injury might give rise to symptoms that are so extraordinary, but also so extraordinary that they're not contemplated by the secretary's code.
Can I get back to the issue of marked interference? Were you done with that thought?
I am.
Marked interference with employment. In your brief, you suggested that there isn't any evidence in this case. Could I get you to respond to the appellant's argument that perhaps there is?
Your Honor, I stand by the brief. I think that the appellant's argument is very consistent with the arguments that are made, which are simply reinterpreting the evidence in a particular light after the board's made its determination. And one can interpret, we're lawyers, and that's often what we do, and one can interpret any set of facts as suggesting that they represent, one fact versus another. And I think that's very common. I don't believe that there's any indication here of marked interference with employment, but I also don't believe that that's a relevant part of the inquiry in this case. Because nothing that the appellant has identified falls outside the scope of his hearing loss. And so moving on further as to whether something unusual or exceptional causes marked interference, there's nothing unusual or exceptional about the veteran's hearing loss.
So you've asked us to essentially rewrite the framework for extra scheduler. Even under the framework that you've proposed, marked interference with employment is a piece of it. So if there is no evidence of marked interference, could the appellant get to prejudice under either framework? I'm just wondering if there's a necessity in this particular case to revisit our case law.
I don't believe that they can. I do believe that that is an important part of the framework, because, Your Honor, the framework, and I think that this also goes to one of the arguments that the appellant made, the framework is not created to grant an extra scheduler evaluation. It's there to manage the pool of cases for which consideration of such an evaluation is warranted. And the first step to the process identifies the likelihood, if a disability is unusual or exceptional because of the injury or disease manifests with unusual or exceptional symptoms, it's more likely that the code may not contemplate it. The second step, Your Honor, focuses on that individual because, again, the standard, the ultimate standard is, you know, to accord justice in the exceptional case where we can't use the rating schedule. So we're looking at the individual veteran at that point to determine whether that unusual or exceptional disability picture causes, or those unusual or exceptional symptoms or signs cause a significant enough impediment in the disability. So while I would suggest that you could answer anything dispositively at the second step, it would be answering it in a very bizarre abstract because you can't say that the symptom, the unusual or exceptional symptoms don't cause something when they don't exist in the first place.
So, Mr. Moon, we get past that hurdle. You're basically asking us to overturn 7 or 8 of our prior precedential opinions. Under the principle of stare decisis, even if we believe those are wrong, that wouldn't be enough for us to avoid applying a prior precedent. There has to be some kind of special justification. In your view, what would that be here?
I believe the justification in this case is twofold. One, it is the way in which the earlier cases have since been interpreted and expanded, because as they have been, it has become more and more inconsistent with 3.321. I think the acknowledgement at this point that the framework that's been created has now encroached significantly on the way that VA rates disabilities, the way that the diagnostic codes and the criteria work, which again is something that this court you know, should consider as a as something that it is its review is limited. It doesn't have that capacity.
That sounds like incorrect. Is there something under the principles of stare decisis that
I believe
just repeat anywhere other than the realm if you think it's not correct, the current framework?
I believe that it's incorrect, but I also believe that it currently does more and more of a disservice to veterans. And I believe that that is also a consideration that the court should make, because I believe that it has led to nothing but the framework has led to nothing but litigation. That the framework, again, doesn't tell you when an extra scheduler evaluation is warranted. That is, there is a single criteria for that. The average impairment in earning capacity of the disability has to be greater than that, which could have been obtained under the rating schedule. That hasn't changed, and that doesn't change. But what we have, what has happened with this case law is that even in this case, the appellant in this case abandoned his appeal of the scheduler evaluation. Why? Because extra scheduler was a lower hanging fruit, because it was easier to grasp onto, because it was easier to get something back to the board so that litigation could, you know, could continue and continue. But to what benefit? None, Your Honor, because again, none of this will result in a higher rating, scheduler or otherwise, for the veteran's hearing loss. And I think that if this court is looking for another reason, it is simply to manage the litigation and to ensure that veterans are actually being appropriately rated. And the way to ensure that veterans are being appropriately rated is to ensure that they're being rated under the rating schedule, which contemplates myriads of disabilities and provides the structure for rating them. Simply sending cases back so that the board can further discuss information that is outside of the realm of consideration for an ultimate rating serves no purpose, Your Honor.
I guess this gets back to what Judge Shulman was asking about. If VA's view is that this framework is unworkable or not viable, why hasn't VA taken steps in the past, or what steps have you taken on your own to try to revamp this, but seeking Federal Circuit appeal, seeking en banc consideration, rewriting your regulations?
I can't speak to policy decisions that were made by the Secretary or the many factors. I would suggest, though, that there are many things that the Secretary considers. There are many things that the General Counsel considers, because VA's process extends far more beyond simply litigating over a provision that does not actually affect many veterans in terms of the provision of benefits. There is far more for VA to allocate its resources to. That has been our position. And it has been our position that while we have engaged in this litigation that, again, from my perspective, much of it could be avoided by focusing on other issues, the end result hasn't much changed, because, again, the end result is simply the award of disability compensation based on the average impairment in earning capacity.
So last question for me on this. Assuming we can get past stare decisis and There are cases that the court is considering overturning. You have a list of cases you'd like us to revisit. Can you explain to us how those cases are relevant to the particular facts here? Something like Peterman was in your list, Martinac, of how a successive case dealing with successive ratings is relevant to the facts of or deciding the facts of this particular case, or Martinac, which is based on what the audiologist needs to do.
I believe they become relevant if the court accepts either the framework that the secretary proposed or at least the limiting factor of the idea that the diagnostic codes and criteria are not meant to create all-encompassing lists of signs or symptoms, but rather are intended to be a metric, variables used to gauge disability level. Because I believe that all of those cases at one point or another stem from, in part, that idea, and stem in part from further and further that case law has encroached on the VA schedule for rating disabilities. To the extent that the secretary is that those cases should be overturned, I came into this as called by the en banc court as to the continued viability of the framework, and so it's more with that in mind that if this framework is redefined, and I think that the appellant made somewhat of a point, the secretary is not asking, or the secretary's position here isn't an extreme position. Truly asking for the original fundamental ideas behind the framework to be eradicated. What the secretary has proposed is a framework that is consistent with both the regulation and the way in which the VA rating schedule works, and with the general burdens of the parties with respect to the duties to discuss certain things, the requirement that evidence shows certain things before discussion is warranted, and the standards of proof that apply in all cases. I think the secretary's proposal, again, the proposed framework simply limits those who are otherwise falling into the pool of the board's R and B, and it takes them outside of that. They were those individuals were not going to receive an extra scheduler evaluation, and so there's no reason to subject them or their cases to ongoing litigation that doesn't result in any benefit. So again, it's simply managing the cases that move through this narrow window, again, into that empty room in the house that you only use when nothing else can accommodate your needs.
So you mentioned that your framework is based on an understanding of how the rating schedule actually works, and so you spend some time in the supplemental memo kind of going over that. And I just want to read you something from your pages 8 and 9. You say the specific variables used to approximate disability level vary between the diagnostic codes based on what metric the secretary determines to be the best indicator of disability level. The fact that a DC uses criteria to approximate disability levels that do not explicitly identify all or some of the symptoms or effects experienced by a veteran does not mean that those symptoms or effects are not contemplated by the relevant percentage evaluation. Now, so wouldn't it be kind of difficult to evaluate a veteran? I mean, I feel like I was taken back to like 1991 when I read this, because basically what you're saying is, hey, there's a lot in a DC that the secretary contemplates that's not even listed in the DC. And so, like, how do we review a claim for, a challenge to an initial eval or a claim for increase if that's the case? I mean, didn't all of our earlier case law kind of build on the view that whatever is said in the schedule, there's nothing else, like, implicit there that the secretary via, hocus pocus actually considered, but it's never mentioned? Didn't we kind of get rid of all that and require that the board actually talk about everything that the veteran has and compare it to the DC? So what are you asking for with this statement here?
I think looking at current case law, it is fair to say that perhaps that is what the court intended. I don't know that it's always been read that way, the court's case law, in terms of what the diagnostic codes represent. I can say, to directly answer your question, it would be to apply the secretary's proposed framework. And applying that framework, I believe, addresses your question directly, because we are asking, Again, and it's understanding the distinction between the disability that results and the injury or disease or that gives rise to that disability. And if we look first to that injury or disease, and we determine whether that injury or disease manifests with unusual or exceptional symptoms, that is our first cue. And that is
how do you do that? What do you look at to decide whether something's unusual if you're not looking at what isn't in the diagnostic code?
The diagnostic codes in the schedule are typically, they are the injury or disease. Right? The names that they're given, and that is how they're typically identified, is by the injury or disease, sometimes something a little bit more descriptive. The criteria is there to determine the level of disability caused by that injury or disease. And we would determine whether an injury or disease manifests with unusual or exceptional circumstances based on the evidence, as we would in any other case or in any other claim. And it's no different, Your Honor.
Can you actually maybe give me an example? Because I'm not understanding how you would do that exercise.
And when you do that, can you, Judge Sholin asked your friend on the other side a question that sort of wraps into this, which is, and is this determination that you're going to describe for us now, it's really starting to sound like a medical question and less like a legal question?
Yes, it is both. There is a underlying medical question, and one would be looking to the evidence of record and whether that evidence provides competence. And I'm not going to say medical. It's simply it requires competent evidence, which in some cases will require a medical determination, but it may not. There are many ways that one could ascertain information. But
can you, when you're giving this example to Judge Sholin, can you give me an example then of something that would not be medical that would be in some other way? Right, because the reason that this matters is from the appellant side, obviously, the answer to the question was this is a question of law, which means that we don't care what the board says on it because we're going to decide it de novo. If it's a question of fact by some other means, then we will defer to the board, but the board can make its own determination. Or if it's a medical question, the board can't itself do it, and in that sense.
They're all implicated, Your Honor. It is a factual question whether a disability, an injury or disease gives rise to unusual signs or symptoms. That may require medical evidence to make that factual determination. For example, and again, I'm having a difficult time coming up with a disability, but we'll take diabetes, because again, the code actually recognizes the exceptional, you know, certain exceptional patterns with it, but diabetes, that includes also blindness. And if all we had was diabetes, the criteria for diabetes, we'd look at the diabetes and we'd look to say, well, what does the record show? There may be an indication any one of a number of ways indicating that the veteran's blindness is not normal. And that could be in a treatment record, because presumably veterans are also receiving treatment for things that are impairing them and their abilities. So it may be in a treatment record. It may be it is a veteran's obligation to prove a claim. So it doesn't have to come in the form of a medical opinion or so on or so forth. The veteran would be seeking, in the case of diabetes, most likely, what he's competent to report, which is that he has been given a diagnosis of diabetes, also that he can't see. It would be up to the record to determine the relationship between those two. It would be up to the record to determine whether one was an unusual manifestation of the other.
So let's just stick with diabetes for a second. So the last time one of your colleagues was here arguing about diabetes, in Peterman it was, and the person used what turned out to be a prophetic example. He said, well, maybe if a person got a bloody nose, okay? And the issue then, let's just assume that somebody has diabetes and they say, listen, I have nosebleeds all the time, right? Would the determination about whether or not bloody noses were contemplated by the diagnostic code for diabetes, would that be a medical question or would that be a legal question that the board would answer?
It's a premature question. It's a premature.
No, it can't be. Because my hypothetical is, at the moment that the board has to decide that question, assume that it has to decide it. I mean, this is not a giantly conceptual question. This is literally the standard of review question for me, which is, if the board has to determine, based on the secretary's test, what is contemplated by a diagnostic code, is that a medical question or legal question or something else?
With due respect, I think there's one missing fact in here. The board wouldn't have to determine that unless there was evidence, one, relating it to it. And we would be looking at that evidence relating it to it. The board doesn't have to discuss issues at all without the evidence.
Assume the doctor, the private doctor, because here's the one thing that's going to happen before we end the argument, is you are going to answer my question.
I understand.
Okay. Assume that a doctor submitted a report that said, based on my medical training and experience and looking at some things online, I think that his bloody nose is related to his diabetes. Then the veteran argues in a brief to the board, the diagnostic code does not contemplate bloody noses. No. The board is then going to say yes or no. When it says yes or no about whether the diagnostic code contemplates it, is that a legal question? Is that a factual question? Or is it a medical question?
It would likely be a factual question requiring medical information.
So,
say that it couldn't be found on, you know, the answer to that question couldn't be found in a Google search, so I'm not suggesting that we would need a medical opinion. What we do need is the evidence that gives rise to the medical question. So, if you could identify...
Can I just stop and follow up with that? So, you use the example of the Google search, right? That would suggest, and this fundamentally is Judge Bartley's question in my mind, which is, so then in deciding whether the diagnostic code contemplates, in my example, bloody noses, the board would look to things other than the diagnostic code? You see, that because why would you look at Google when the natural reaction would be you'd look at the diagnostic code, right?
No, because the initial inquiry isn't about, before you can understand what the disability is, you have to look at the signs and symptoms of the injury or disease. Diabetes is a disease, and that's what's being rated. So we want to determine whether the diabetes is manifesting with unusual or exceptional circumstances. It's the very first part of the analysis into extra scheduler. We want to know whether there is anything about this veteran's diabetes that is manifesting unusual or exceptional. The disability is not the diabetes. Disability is caused by the diabetes. The disability is caused by the manifestations of the veteran's disability as it pertains to the impairment in function and ultimately the compensation based on the average impairment in, you know, earning capacity. But we're not simply we're not turning to the code yet, because that code is contemplating the diabetes, and that diabetes. The code itself, the very nature of the code and its sequential, like multiple evaluations, is also considering levels of severity. And those levels of severity may not be common. They may actually be unusual levels of severity. And I'd submit that they probably are, because most people don't manifest with the same level of severity of an injury or disease. We might all injure our knee at some point. It does not mean that none of us can, you know, that generally we can't flex our knee past a certain degree. Right, so the diagnostic codes already contemplate unusual or extreme forms in terms of the severity of the disability level. So we're not turning to them first. We're first turning to the injury or the disease, and we're looking to determine whether that injury or disease manifests with something unusual. Is there a likelihood that the criteria that the secretary chose to gauge disability level may not be accurate and reliable?
So in this case, Mr. Long has articulated that he has ear pain. Hearing loss, whether you look at what hearing loss means on Google or in the diagnostic code, doesn't talk about ear pain. It talks about inability to hear. So why would that not be unusual? Let's assume it impacts his employment for our purposes. Why is it not unusual?
I believe foremost that, again, we can't, I think it is very hard to answer these questions in an abstract.
This is not abstract. This is accurate. I mean, specific.
He has complained of ear pain, but what he complained of is that he doesn't like to use his hearing aids, and therefore when people scream at him, it hurts his ears. That is very different than a suggestion that the trauma that caused his hearing loss has now produced ear pain. This is simply a byproduct of the veteran's decision not to wear his hearing aids. And again, it is a personal circumstances because he has chosen to allow people to scream at him to the point where it hurts his ears. So I don't believe, Your Honor, if the evidence showed that the underlying trauma, the acoustic trauma that caused the veteran's hearing loss, or if it was a disease that caused the veteran's hearing loss, also produced pain and hearing loss, again, the first question would be, was the veteran's disability properly categorized as simply hearing loss? That's the first question, and that's the more important question to ask. If it was properly categorized as hearing loss, and there is no other analogous code that could have been used, which I'd submit that there may have been, but if that was the only other symptom, then yes, maybe we would make it through the first step of the analysis in that case. But again, we don't actually have that evidence. We don't have any evidence suggesting that the underlying trauma or the underlying disease caused pain as well as a manifestation of that injury or disease. What we have is a complaint derivative of the veteran's disability. I apologize.
The appellant actually phrases his ear pain as pain when using his hearing aids in a loud environment, not failure to use them so people yell at him. So
you're right. I apologize. I think he had testified several different ways, but the pain from wearing the hearing aids as well, correct?
Yeah, that was my understanding of how they right. described it. So it's not how he's choosing to deal with his disability. He's doing what the doctor advises him.
I would submit two things. I mean, one, again, the pain, if it's being produced by the hearing aid, again, is not related to the underlying injury or disease. I'm not suggesting, my statement here is no way intended to suggest what may occur elsewhere in the rating schedule. What I'm trying to convey here is that the appropriate means to seek compensation is not through 3.321B if the symptom is derivative of an intervening act and not the underlying injury or disease. If it's if it can't be compensated, it can't be compensated, but that doesn't mean that it would be compensated in this case. The Secretary, again, we have to look to see if the veteran was rated under a corresponding or analogous code. That is the first question. If it's not, that's the error. If the veteran has ear pain because he's using a hearing aid, which I would also suggest is meant to ameliorate the effects of what he's being compensated for. So with the hearing aid, he doesn't necessarily actually have the same level of hearing loss if the hearing aid is working.
So your prior response was he was bad because he didn't want to wear his hearing aids and people yelled at him, and now he's bad because he's wearing hearing aids, so...
I'm not saying there's no judgment as to the veteran himself. The question here is whether the veteran is being adequately compensated for the average impairment in earning capacity caused by his disability. The question is whether the rating schedule has the tool, can properly and adequately accommodate the veteran. And in this case, what we're looking to is that the code does. It presumptively does. Because I apologize if I'm not following your question, Your Honor, but again, I'm not saying that the veteran may not be entitled to to secondary disability. I'm not saying that the veteran may not be entitled to some other relief under the code. What I'm simply suggesting is that we do not run to extra scheduler because this is not a sign or symptom related to the impairment in functioning of the veteran's ear.
So are you asserting that the court should remand the ear pain assertion to be determined if it can be rated some other way under Morgan?
No, because...
So did VA already do that then?
To be honest, Your Honor, it doesn't matter. The appellant abandoned his challenge to the scheduler evaluations of his hearing loss and whatever was within the scope of his claim. And that, again, is the problem.
Yes, but so... This has come up in other situations, and so when an appellant abandons, either by not appealing or by entering into a JMR, if it's here and going back, okay, abandons a scheduler rating, why should we interpret that as all scheduler ratings for everything and just, as opposed to, so there's two ways to look at that. One is the way that you just done, right, which is that the appellant abandoned the scheduler rating and that's the whole kit and caboodle. The other is that the appellant abandoned the pure hearing loss scheduler rating, meaning with the Roman numerals and all of that. But if there's something else that under Morgan could be rated under the scheduler, but they framed this as we put this in the extra scheduler basket, it seems like one of Morgan's purposes was to say, we're all jumping to extra scheduler too soon. You can use other things on the schedule. So the mere fact that you've agreed to not do the a scheduler rating for hearing loss doesn't necessarily encompass these other things.
Your Honor, I see that I have 45 seconds, so I will try to answer it very quickly, which is that Morgan, while it did shift the direction and the focus, I believe, of both the court and, you know, and, you know, perhaps the parties, Morgan did not say anything that hadn't pre-existed Morgan. Those duties and obligations pre-existed Morgan, and those were the responsibilities of claimants to advocate and for appellants represented by counsel to argue before this court. Morgan didn't change that. If the board had a duty at the time, the board had that duty at that time. And again, part of the secretary's position here is simply to ensure that claims are being litigated in the most appropriate forum with the highest prospect of benefit, and not allowing this to simply become a tool of litigation, a low-hanging fruit to facilitate further litigation. I see that my time is up.
You may have additional 5 minutes. We have other questions. Go ahead.
So you also say in your supplemental memo that I'll read it to give you a little bit of context. It's on pages 12 and 13. You say disability evals are based on the average impairment in earning capacity caused by a disability, not the way in which a disability personally impacts an individual veteran based on his or her specific circumstances. And this is the sentence I'm interested in. Then you say the particular circumstances of an individual veteran are irrelevant to the adequacy of a disability eval and thus are also irrelevant to any consideration of whether an extra scheduler eval is warranted. Now, did you mean to couch that in a different way? Because I have always thought of both TDIU and extra scheduler as involving the particular, you know, the particularities of a veteran's individual circumstances.
TDIU, yes. I meant this statement in the context of assigning evaluations, not individual unemployment. I fully agree that TDIU is based on the individual's particular circumstances.
But seemingly you don't agree that an individual's particular circumstances are relevant to an extra scheduler eval.
Correct.
So explain
because
to me why
3.321 authorizes no more than is authorized elsewhere under the rating schedule, which is an evaluation commensurate with the average impairment in earning capacity caused by a disability. The average impairment in earning capacity caused by a disability. And the disability, again, being as defined both by regulation, through statute and case law, that disability is the impairment of functioning of, you know, caused by the underlying injury or disease. A veteran who rolls down his window because of hearing loss,
so let's go, but I kind of agree with you on the rolling down the window thing, but I want to just talk about this for a few more minutes, and maybe we're getting at what I think of as an inherent contradiction.
Okay.
In the extra scheduler regulation, which I'll read to you, and then I have another question. So 3.321 says, to accord justice to the exceptional case where the scheduler eval is inadequate, the director of comp or the delegee is authorized to approve on the basis of the criteria set forth in this paragraph, an extra scheduler eval commensurate with the average impairment of earning capacity. So it meant it references average impairment of earning capacity. And then it also talks about the governing norm being a finding by the director of comp or the delegee that application of the regular scheduler standards is impractical because the disability is so exceptional or unusual to due to related factors such as market. So that part, you know, the sentence right after the one that references average and permanent earning capacity seems to reference the veteran's particular individualized circumstances more akin to TDIU, you know, in my view.
And
so let me just finish this up. So you, in your brief, you reference one of my memorandum decisions, Thrasher.
It's bound to happen. It had to be somebody.
Which I do not take personally. But in that case, the veteran was a machinist or something. It was working around this dangerous loud machines. And the director of public safety in the for that factory wrote a letter and said, this guy can't even hear these machines going. He's a danger working here because of his service-connected hearing loss, essentially. So, I mean, I'm just kind of confused about why you're saying that individual circumstances don't play a role in ES considerations or referral considerations when they seem to.
Then that there, perhaps I miscommunicated. They are not irrelevant to the consideration. But again, the consideration, the first steps, whether it's the original fund framework or the proposed framework, again, that's managing the pool of cases for which the actual analysis will be undertaken. The actual analysis is what 3.321, the authorization is only for the award commensurate with the average impairment and earning capacity. So the actual assignment, and I see my time is expiring again.
You just have more time.
The actual assignment of the evaluation does not consider the veteran's individual circumstances. Where those are considered are in that second prong, that marked interference with, you know, with employments. Because again, otherwise, a veteran's personal circumstances, they're not irrelevant to the entire scope of things. Very often those circumstances, these signs or these symptoms or how a veteran is affected may very well be relevant to what diagnosis they have. They're used by doctors to determine what a veteran might have, and in characterizing that, to the same extent, they may, in the outside world, be relevant to ascertaining perhaps like the level of the severity of someone's disability. But again, the secretary has chosen very specific criteria to assess the level of severity with, and for good reason. And those are as reflected in the Federal Register, especially with respect to newer codes that have been revised, that these are based on science, these are based on medicine. They are the most universal, generalizable criteria used to evaluate a disability, and it's reflected again in the hearing loss code itself. So while a veteran might complain, and intuitively we want to accept that because we know intuitively it's not relevant if all we were doing was in the outside world looking at someone and determining whether they were impaired. But that's not what we're doing. We're not in the outside world. We're within a structure, and that structure, Congress delegated the authority to the secretary to determine how to assess disability level and how to rate that. And again, the only authorization that the secretary has made under 3.321B is to authorize compensation commensurate with the average impairment in earning capacity caused by disability. And again, how a veteran is personally impacted is not an average impairment. And some veterans will have faced greater hardship than other veterans because of their disability. I understand the policy reasons why one might want a system based on actual impairment, but that is not the system that exists. And that's not the system that Congress mandated, and it's not the system that the secretary created. And there are very many reasons for that.
I think it's tied up in what you were saying earlier, that the issue of average impairment plays into the question of assignment of disability.
Correct.
But I do think you need to look at the individualized veteran and their circumstance to assess whether they get referred.
I agree.
Okay, because that was not clear.
I apologize. As a second part of that analysis.
Again. No, not just in the marked interference, because otherwise how do you know what other unusual whatever it is that you're talking about.
That's personal.
Individualized.
Circumstances, though, are different. By the time a veteran is rated, he's been given a diagnosis and service connection has been granted. So at that point, if that hasn't been challenged or appealed, that is what the veteran has as a factual matter. I fully agree that a veteran's personal circumstances may be relevant in the context of treatment, in the context of ascertaining, well, I'm not sure. The veteran has complained about, veteran says that he has to raise his TV. The veteran says that his wife or you know, his spouse repeats him or herself frequently. Maybe we should get the veteran hearing testing because maybe the veteran has hearing loss. So I'm not saying it's irrelevant information, but the relevance is very particular to a you know to a certain time and moment, and that is to assessing the actual disease or injury that the veteran has. The same thing with the veteran. You know, if a veteran complains to a doctor, I can't hear, but also I feel very dizzy. The diagnosis, I don't believe, should simply be, if the two are related, you know, to the same underlying disease or injury, the diagnosis probably shouldn't just be hearing loss.
So, okay, before we lose all time here, can you address under your proposed framework how the board should have treated the self-esteem issue that appellant's counsel talked about? So that I'm looking at your Morgan memo now that talks about these different steps.
The self-esteem issue, Your Honor, again, I don't believe is something that required further consideration. I don't think that the veteran stated.
Yeah, but you can't just say that. I mean, you have to. They've claimed this, and now I'm just asking you to address that aspect of their claim under the framework that you suggested in Morgan, which I have been assuming is the one that you're adhering
correct.
To yes. Here when you talk about a framework. Okay.
Under the framework, does the veteran or the diagnostic criteria in the corresponding or analogous code fair approximators of disability level? And the first question under that, does evidence show that the injury or disease that gives rise to the disability manifests with unusual or exceptional signs or symptoms? No, it does not.
So they would just say no, self-esteem?
Low self-esteem is not a sign or a symptom of hearing loss. And even in the most common sense, if someone, you know, if I were to be approached and somebody said to me, I have very low self-esteem, nowhere in my mind would it go to you must have hearing loss, or maybe you have hearing loss. And I think that's relevant because that is what the board is tasked with.
And the board can make that determination without a medical judgment.
I believe that there are some issues, yes, because again,
about self-esteem.
Yes.
So the board can just on its own say, and this may be right, I don't mean this to be pejoratively sounding, the board can literally simply say, that is not related to hearing loss. That is not a function of hearing loss.
I think there are very many cases where it doesn't require medical expertise to make that that statement. However, in this case, I don't believe that the board would need to go so far. The board would need to state that there is no competent evidence suggesting that the low self-esteem is caused by the injury or disease that resulted in your hearing loss. Because that is the operative information that's lacking from this. It is.
What about the veteran saying, I think, I have a low self-esteem because I'm having trouble hearing. If the board can make the determination that self-esteem isn't connected to hearing loss, then wouldn't it be competent lay evidence that the board would have to discuss that the veteran says it is?
At best, the veteran's statement suggests a secondary relationship between his disability and something else. Because that's what, with due respect, Your Honor, that is what your statement said. I have low self-esteem because of my hearing loss. Not I have low self-esteem because of the injury that caused my hearing loss, because of the disease that caused my hearing loss. When we are rating a disability, we are rating that disability. And while there may be corollary disabilities that arise from primary disabilities, that is not what extra scheduler is for. It's not meant to compensate. It doesn't pull things. Again, we can't pull things into that empty room without then encroaching on the rest of the house. And that's what we'd be doing here by entertaining that idea without evidence suggesting that the low self-esteem is actually a sign or symptom of the underlying injury or disease.
Well, but what if we did have, let's say, we're getting out of the facts of Mr. Long's case, I think. What if they did have a medical opinion? Some psychiatrist said low self-esteem is due to these hearing loss issues.
Again, I believe there's a critical distinction, and I don't think I'm conveying it very well, but there's a distinction between suggesting that something is related to the disability and something is related to the injury or disease that gives rise to the disability. If something is related to the disability, then primarily that would raise an issue of, you know, potential a secondary relationship between one thing and the next. If the injury or disease manifests with, again, in diabetes, the diabetes can manifest with a number of symptoms, and the loss of vision is also one of those things that is not caused by the resulting disability, it's caused by the diabetes itself. And so in that sense, it is not the disability that causes the loss of vision, it is again the underlying disease that causes it, and that's how it's related to it. In this particular case, if a medical examiner said that yes, when the veteran was seeking service connection and the veteran said, I have all of these symptoms, your low self-esteem is directly attributable to the injury that you sustained, which not only affected your ear, but also near your ear, and it somehow affected your brain. Yes, we would that easily addressed under the schedule, because we would have potentially two different disabilities, and the board would have to engage in the same analysis required to any time a veteran states that they believe they're entitled to compensation or the service connection for a claim. So I hope that answered the question, or did it?
I'll listen to the tape and find out.
It's at minute 72. Thank you, Your Honors. Okay. There are no further questions.
Ms. Elmer, should you need it, you have 15 additional minutes.
Your Honors, we agree that extra scheduler is a last resort. And we also agree that there needs to be a link between the veteran's signs or symptoms that he's asserted are exceptional or unusual and the underlying service-connected disability. We also agree that extra scheduler is not meant to be looked at in a vacuum, and I think Morgan made that clear. Everything that the Secretary says he wants, he received in Morgan. You don't look at extra scheduler in a vacuum. You look at the schedule first, and if at the end of that schedule analysis there's something that's still on the table, then you go to extra scheduler. It's not an end goal. We understand that it's an exceptional circumstance. A veteran is not wanting to get extra scheduler. He would much rather want all of his disabilities, symptoms, and effects to be compensated by the scheduler. It'd be a lot easier for the board to adjudicate that. It'd be a lot easier for the court to adjudicate it. But at the end of the day, the Secretary made this regulation, and now he simply wants to rewrite the framework in a way that insulates his decisions from judicial review. You know, he talked a lot about how the court doesn't have the authority to review the rating schedule, but we're not reviewing the rating schedule here. If the Secretary had wanted to make 3.321 an equitable provision, he could have done so. He could have implemented it under 503. Instead, he implemented it under 1155. And this court has done its job in interpreting the regulation.
Could I ask you to respond specifically to the point about the fact that if you in some way appeal and only raise extra scheduler, or if you had in another case, a JMR that only focused on extra scheduler. What's your take on the Secretary's response that waives all arguments under the schedule, not just, say, for example, under the diagnostic code for hearing loss, but rating things by analogy, secondary service connection issues, in other words, that you've sort of put all your bags in one basket?
I think it depends on the context, Your Honor. So, for example, in this case, the Secretary, you know, mentioned that we had abandoned scheduler avenue. But as I mentioned, the board decision in this case was in March of 2016. We didn't have the benefit of all the case law that preceded it. And at that point, extra scheduler consideration seemed like the best option for the veteran. And so if you're looking at the context of that, I think you're right. You can't have the veteran didn't willingly abandon all avenues of the scheduler criteria, because I think it's only really been made clear how this extra scheduler framework works within the context of the schedule, most recently in Morgan. And so I think it would be different now. I think veterans now and advocates now are savvier about what they're putting in their JMRs, and if they're going to give up the scheduler avenues now, I think they might have given up every scheduler avenue. I think it depends on the context of the JMR. It depends on if the veteran was represented at court, and I know most veterans now are represented at court, but I think in the past, that's my point before challenging the Secretary's point about this being needless litigation. We needed all of this precedent to get to this point where we really know how the board is supposed to be conducting this analysis. And so I don't think the Secretary or the veteran in this case gave up all of his scheduler avenues because he didn't know how it was supposed to work back in pre-2016. So, as I mentioned, I think the Secretary simply wants to rewrite his regulations or his framework in order to insulate his decisions from judicial review. I think Judge Bartley and Judge Hillen were getting at where there's really no guidance on how the Secretary's proposed framework is supposed to work, either for the board to apply it, for the court to review it, or for the veteran to understand it. And I think that, you know, if we are to adopt this proposed framework, rather than get rid of litigation, we would just be going back to the beginning of THUN, where we have to determine what is a fair approximator of the diagnostic criteria, or what material impeding employment really means. And so I would ask this court to decline to adopt the Secretary's proposed framework, to affirm it's more than 10 years of carefully considered, well-thought-out case law, and to vacate and remand this veteran's decision.
That was a lovely conclusion, but I have a question.
Thank you.
At the end, your opposing counsel was asserting that perhaps self-esteem might have been addressed as a secondary service connection, but that's not a recognizable disability with a diagnosis like depression or anxiety would have been. What do you think, are you asserting that those kinds of amorphous or less than manifesting to a full disability or diagnosable disease, perhaps an undiagnosed illness, we might call it, would be the kind of thing that would be subject to extra scheduler evaluation?
I think that it could go through the scheduler avenues first. I think the analysis needs to be done. You know, in Saunders, the Federal Circuit made clear that you don't need to have a diagnosis of a disability if you have some underlying functional impairment. And so, you know, it's possible that, for example, in this case, secondary service connection was denied. I could see a scenario where secondary service connection could be granted based on self-esteem issues and rated analogously to the psych diagnostic code. I think it depends on the particular facts and the particular impairment. But if in adjudicating the particular facts of the veteran's case, they reach that end of that scheduler road and self-esteem is still on the table, ear pain is still on the table, that is when those are relevant to the extra scheduler consideration.
Isn't the fact that secondary service connection was denied here pretty significant?
It's not insignificant, Your Honor. you know, I think, as I mentioned, I think the timeline is really important here. And as I mentioned with Judge Allen, you know, if there really is no nexus between anxiety and depression and the hearing loss disability, then that is off the table. But there hasn't been that requisite finding for self-esteem. So at the very least, I think that you know, the court should vacate and remand the board's decision to discuss the veteran's self-esteem issues, his ear pain, and his social isolation.
Anything else?
Right. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you all very much. The case is submitted for consideration. The court will now come down and greet us.
All rise.